This is The Sporkful.
Real quick at the top here, friends, before we dive in, I know that most of you are probably not Jewish and many of you may not eat matzah, but I urge you to stick with this episode, even if you may think at first blush it's not for you, because it is for you. It's for all of us. Matzah is just a type of cracker, and actually a really delicious cracker. And in my research for this episode, I've actually learned that a lot of non-Jewish people that I've spoken to love matzah all year round because it's delicious, and frankly, compared to fancier crackers, it's cheap. And in fact, one of my two guests in this show is a Southern Baptist expert on matzah and the science of making matzah. So join us one and all. This is an all-inclusive discussion of matzah today on The Sporkful. This is The Sporkful. It's not for foodies, it's for eaters. I'm Dan Pashman, and we're about to challenge your assumptions about consumption and drop a sporkful of knowledge on you. Because we're obsessively compulsive about eating more awesomely, and because if history has taught us anything, it's that the hosts of food shows need a lot of catchphrases. Passover starts next week, and that means that today's topic for mastication and rumination is matzah. Now, with apologies to my Hebrew school teachers, I'm going to give an extremely abbreviated background on matzah. As you may recall, back in the Old Testament and back in ancient times, the Jews were slaves in Egypt. They were fleeing slavery in Egypt. They were in a rush. Moses was taking them, and they did not have time for their bread to rise, for the bread to leaven. And so they ate unleavened bread, which is matzah. And every year at Passover, Jews eat matzah and avoid eating leavened bread. And depending on how observant they are, a bunch of other things. So that's the extremely brief backstory. I traveled recently to the Manischewitz factory in Newark, New Jersey. Manischewitz is the largest manufacturer of kosher products in America. They make a ton of matzah in addition to a whole bunch of other things. And I interviewed two people. One is this guy, Randall Copeland, who's the vice president of operations. He's the Southern Baptist. We get into the science of matzah with him. Then I interviewed Rabbi Yaakov Horowitz, who is in charge of all kosher certification for Manischewitz. He's the one that makes sure that everything they make is actually kosher. Now, to put his job into secular terms, if the Old Testament is like the U.S. Constitution, and great works in Jewish theology are subsequent Supreme Court rulings, Rabbi Horowitz is like the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. And I posed to him some very Sporkful-esque legal-type questions, such as, is an open-faced matzah sandwich actually a sandwich? We will see how he rules. So, I take you now to the Manischewitz factory.
My name is Randall Copeland. I'm Vice President of Operations for the Manischewitz Company in Newark, New Jersey.
And you're originally from where in Georgia?
That would be Thomasville, Georgia, just north of Tallahassee, Florida.
And you were raised Southern Baptist?
I was.
So what's a nice Southern boy like you doing in a place like this?
When I was, I had completed working a job in Canada for a company called Menu Foods, which was sold. And so I was looking for work, and this job was very, very interesting because they had just recently gone through a consolidation and consolidated three plants into this facility, and they needed some help getting things organized and put together, and that was the kind of thing I felt very comfortable doing.
And that's your background, is basically running large food operations.
I've worked in operations. I started with the Campbell Soup Company, and then I spent about a decade running marketing and sales, actually at that point in pet food.
So some of my listeners certainly are Jewish, but this is a general food and eating interest show, and so most of my listeners are not Jewish. So from the perspective of a guy who's not Jewish, who makes matzah all day, among other products, explain what matzah is.
Matzah is the original bread, unleavened bread of Moses. It is an important food for religious reasons, but it's also a very good, very plain and basic cracker.
I agree. I think that matzah sometimes gets a bad rap. I think that it's a great cracker. You know, so many crackers are oily or salty. They got a lot of seasoning. They're heavy. And if you're just going to eat the cracker, maybe that's what you want. But if you're going to put a spread or a dip or something else on top of it, that's already going to have salt and seasoning in it. And it's nice to have a plain cracker, I think. I think that matzah is a great snack cracker for all people all year round. Tell me about the first time you ever ate matzah. What was your reaction?
First time I ever ate matzah, in all truth, was out of a communion plate in a Baptist church.
Okay.
And that is not uncommon, and it's entirely appropriate use for matzah.
Do you just have matzah just around your house all the time?
Oh, yeah. If I didn't, my wife would think I probably wasn't doing my job here.
Do you get as much free matzah as you want?
No, I don't. I pay for it like everybody else.
Oh, okay. You don't get like one box a week or something?
Well, once in a while, there's some that we bring in for some sampling in the lab.
Okay.
That finds its way to my car.
All right,
I'll
fair
have
enough.
To be honest.
Is the whole office kosher? I mean, like, do you have rules? Like, if you bring in your lunch, does it have to be kosher, or how does that work?
The office itself is not kosher at all.
So you could, in theory, bring in a BLT for lunch and eat it in the office cafeteria.
That's correct. But once you get into the working part of the business, once you get into the lab, now all those rules change.
Let's talk about R&D, because that. I'm generally really interested in sort of the science of what big companies and how they decide to make foods a certain way. Let's start off talking about crunch. Crunch is part of what makes matzah great, and crunch is part of what makes so many crackers and snack foods great, to the point that some junk food companies have machines, you may know about this, that measure the amount of bite force required to break a chip or snack food, and they have determined that human beings, on average, like 4 pounds per square inch of pressure to break a cracker. That's what humans want in crunch. They want 4 pounds per square inch. Is this something that you guys have researched independently here, the ideal level of crunch? How many PSI does it take to break a piece of Manischewitz matzah? Talk to me about the science of crunch here.
The way we work with those kinds of aesthetic values on food is...
Oh, Randall, excuse me. That is much more than aesthetic. That is not just aesthetics. Crunch is not just an aesthetic value, sir.
Okay, crunch...
I object.
Crunch is very serious.
Okay, all right. Go on, though,
please. The way we work with those kinds of values is we bring in people. A lot of the folks from the office participate in regular test panels. And we ask them some very specific things about taste, texture, crunch being one of them, one of the more important ones, and we get their feedback. So we don't necessarily have the instrumentation to do the same kind of measurement that perhaps a Nabisco would be able to do, but we certainly get that information from the human side by direct comparison, A versus B versus C versus D.
So but crunch is definitely a factor.
Crunch will have a lot to do with how people like things like crackers in particular.
Is there such thing as too much crunch?
Sure. You can have things that are too brittle. Absolutely.
And what are some things you can do? Like, I mean, when you are, let's say you make 10 different crackers that are on the spectrum of crunch, from 1 being least to 10 being too crunchy. What ingredient, what processes are changing along that spectrum to all ingredient or cooking process? What's changing along that spectrum to alter the crunch?
Well, in the cooking process, you're working with time, temperature, and relative humidity. So you can change the rate at which you dry that product or the terminal point where you dry that product to as you go through the oven, how fast you cook it, how harshly you're treating the moisture of it, how much you hold in when you let it out. And that will have a lot to do within a given formula. Then, of course, there's so many variables by changing the ingredients that's in a formula. Now, in things like matzah, you don't have any choice on ingredients. You're dealing with kosher flour and water. Story's over.
Another component of the matzah experience that I think makes it a great cracker and different from other crackers is the charring. There's a slight char around the trim that I really enjoy.
We call that the border.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah. Or the frame.
Okay.
So you like a matzo that has a nice dark frame.
That's right.
Yeah.
Have you experimented with how much frame and how dark it should be? And where do you come down on that?
Well, here's where we come down. When I have about the same number of customer complaints about it being too dark as I have that it's too light, right. I know I probably have it at about the right level.
This is a point between you and some of your competitors that Correct. Some are more charred than others.
When you have the same functional ingredient defined for you, flour and water, then the only real difference you have is in thickness and process and how much you cook it. So in order to have some difference and because of individual taste and regionality, there are matzahs that are cooked very dark. Ours is more in the middle. And in some parts of the world, matzah is a little lighter.
One of the other hallmark components of matzah, well, really of all crackers, but I think more so with matzah, is the little holes up and down it, which, as I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, but those are commonly in all sorts of crackers, especially mass-produced crackers, and they're just meant to pop out of the bubbles. You don't get air bubbles.
Well, they have, they have some very defined reasons for being.
But people out there who have never seen a piece of matzah, if you look at a Ritz cracker or a saltine, you will see those same little holes in them. So this goes beyond matzah.
The number of holes you have and their pattern and the distance between them will have a lot to do with how that product tastes and performs.
Tell me about that. How so?
Well, the further they are apart, the more you allow for expansion. Whenever you're cooking this dough, it's going through very hot ovens. The water turns into steam. It expands by approximately 1,600 times in volume. And that water, now steam, has to escape. And as it escapes, it opens up the structure and forms these bubbles that you see on crackers. And that's important in that it sets the texture that cracker is going to have when the process is finished. So the more you separate those holes, which really are spot wells, if you think of it that way. That's where you lock those layers together to prevent them from expanding. The further apart they are, the more you allow it to expand, the bigger the bubbles are, the more open the structure. We call them docking. You dock the cracker, that is, you run it through a machine that's designed to put those specific holes in there, really those spot wells into the matzah.
And am I correct that matzah tends to have more of those per square inch than other crackers?
Matzah has a lot. When you look at a sheet of Manischewitz, you're generally going to have about 700
wow.
of those docks.
Now, I think of those holes, I mean, I understand they're there for a purpose in terms of the cooking process. But I kind of think of them, because on matzah, and other crackers, they're often like in a circle or they're in some sort of other pattern. And matzah, they're in straight lines, very straight lines, the whole length from one edge to the other. I tend to think of them more as perforations. I think that they make it easier to break the matzah, because one matzah can be kind of unwieldy, depending on what you're using it for. So you're often going to be breaking matzah up. What's your personal technique for breaking matzah into smaller pieces?
I learned from the Misgiyaks.
These are the rabbinical supervisors.
These are our rabbinical supervisors who are there to make sure that matzah is in fact kosher for Passover. And part of their job at the end of the oven is to test for correct doneness and snap of that matzah. So they do it many times a day and day after day. So if you go watch these guys who do this for a living, you'll see that they make their first break on the matzah about halfway through along the perforations, as you call them, or the docking holes. Then they make the second break opposite of that, so you wind up with four nice pieces out of a sheet of matzah.
So they break against the grain.
They bake the second break against the grain. And it works out great almost every time.
Are they able to get four equal-sized
within
squares?
Within reason, they're fairly equal. They're not perfect, but yeah, absolutely.
I would love to see that. Because breaking against the grain and getting a straight line break against the grain is really an art. I mean, that is not easy to do.
It's not that hard. If you look at the guys do it in about a minute, you'll figure it out.
Can you do it?
Yeah.
What's the secret?
just use your thumb on the top and spread the force with your fingers on the bottom, and it'll pop.
So it's sort of like just a focused pressure in a specific point.
That's all. It's not difficult. The thing that's interesting is this is a traditional method for checking Matz's doneness. And when I first got here, I looked at that and said, you know, this is kind of a strange practice. So I would go out and break matzah with them and talk to them and figure out what they were doing. And I learned within about 3 months, I could tell within 0.2% moisture what that matzah was just by breaking it in the way they broke it. So that tradition was backed in some pretty good facts when it was all said and done.
Huh. I will say that while most of the time you're better off having a piece of matzah with straight edges, or if you break it, you want straight edges, the jagged piece that you sometimes get from breaking against the grain also, I think, does have its merits. It's nice to have a pointy thing to sometimes stick into a dip if you need to pierce them, or use it more of a scooping mechanism if you want something thin to get in there. It's also good for getting into narrow openings, like you're dipping it straight into a jar or something, but you still want a big piece of matzah, so you kind of have a thin, jagged, pointy tip. Have you experimented with oddly shaped matzahs?
We have in the past. It's not something that we've worked with lately. We do make matzah crackers, and matzah crackers are made in a very efficient design. They have 6 sides. And the reason they have 6 sides is because you can put those together in a pattern, and it completely consumes the sheet of dough as it goes into the oven, so you have minimal amount of waste. And so that's why your matzah crackers that you have are actually little hexagons.
Interesting. That is interesting. But no other, you haven't done, I mean, like, what about a piece of matzah shaped like a spoon?
We haven't worked with that lately. I'm sure somewhere back in history they've done some interesting things.
Does matzah go stale?
Matzah will go stale.
But, I mean, in general, it lasts a while.
Matzah has a good long life because it's so dry.
You know, it strikes me that matzah is like the ideal food for crossing the desert with.
It is. It is.
When you're not in the lab in the kosher areas here, I assume you eat pork, you eat everything, right?
Sure.
Like I'm Jewish, I do too. I grew up not kosher at all. Pork, shellfish, cheese on top. I love it all. I asked because I'm curious. So I threw this question out on Facebook to my audience. I'm going to Manischewitz. I'm going to talk about matzah. You got any questions? What are some of your thoughts? So Caroline Day on Facebook wrote, I'm confident I'm going to hell for this, but it's great with ham. She says, an open-faced sandwich or cracker approach using really salty ham. And if I'm feeling the need, I add berry jam to bring the sweet in with the salty and crunchy. Now, I have to admit, Randall, that sounds delicious to me.
Sounds like we need to hire her to do some consulting and new product development. Yeah.
I don't know how long she'd last here. Have you ever, outside of your work here at home with the matzah, have you ever tried anything like that?
I've never tried anything like that, no. But some of the uses that I've used matzah for probably would never be considered kosher in any place, anytime.
All right. Well, Randall Copeland from Manischewitz, thanks so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for coming and visiting with us today.
My name is Rabbi Yaakov Horowitz. Technically, I work for the Orthodox Union, who gives the kosher supervision of the Manischewitz company. And I am here on full-time location on behalf of the Orthodox Union, and I'm in charge of all kosher operations, making sure that it's all kept proverbial kosher.
Right.
Literally and figuratively. There's a lot to say about matzah. From a kosher supervision standpoint, it is the most intensively supervised kosher product. Matzah is supervised from when the wheat is cut on the fields, actually. We have a rabbi in the flour mill someplace in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and he supervises many, many, many tanker trucks of kosher for Passover flour, which are sent daily during the Passover season to our facility.
So some of the rules about the way it needs to be prepared have their origin in the Torah, in the Jewish Bible, but many others have sort of been refined and codified over many millennia since then.
Correct.
In many great works. Here at the Manischewitz plant, you have, as I understand it, an 18-minute rule. Can you please explain that?
Any kosher matzah, actually, here's how it works. That the preeminent guiding principle for matzah is that it has to be unleavened. The Bible says unleavened bread. When the Bible says it's unleavened, what does unleavened mean? So the rabbis, either, as you say, from the Bible or from subsequent decisions, had very clear guidelines of what constitutes leaven. If you have flour and water, no other ingredients, and you mix them and you get it into a oven within 18 minutes, then the flour does not have the dough does not have a chance to leaven, according to the rabbis. That's what really the main thing that all of the rabbinic inspectors are looking for, making sure that that this 18-minute rule is implemented.
And if something goes wrong on the assembly line and there's a brief delay and it's 19 minutes, what happens?
Okay, so that's a good question. The actual production from water to adding to flour till the time it gets to the oven can vary anywhere between 12 and 15 minutes. We have a 3-minute cushion in there to make sure that we don't fall afoul of the 18-minute rule. But let's say one of the machines stopped working, or like today we have a little bit of a blackout. So there actually is a stopwatch, which the rabbi hits and everybody's the eyes are on the clock. We want to make sure that the product is produced. If it's not produced, then all of the product gets off the line, that's in front of the oven, thrown into the trash, and a very significant cleaning process takes place, about an hour and a half.
Wow. And so the lights went out here in the factory right now as we speak. Does that mean that's happening right now?
Yes. It happens very rarely, but we happen to have, I guess it's in honor of the Sporkful people that somebody pulled the plug.
Right. Can you give me a brief sketch? Why not 19 minutes?
Well, there's some kind of tradition handed down, something about walking the Roman mile. And there was a Talmudic calculation that the Roman mile is walked in less than 18, is walked in 18 minutes. And again, we're not saying that it has to ferment if it's more than 18 minutes, but we want to guarantee that it won't ferment. So it definitely will not ferment in less than 18 minutes.
Now, people should know, I'm sure even folks who don't know much about kosher law, they vaguely understand that there's the term kosher. But then there is also kosher for Passover.
Correct.
Which means it must also fulfill this other set of rules that only applies during Passover.
Right, an additional set of rules.
Right. Now, am I correct that there is some matzah that is not kosher for Passover?
Yes. And this actually, it's a good question, because this creates a great amount of confusion.
So here's where I want to kind of call on you, or ask you to call upon your knowledge as I put it, sort of a Supreme Court justice of kosher law.
Thank you.
And certainly, as I said, I do not pretend to be nearly as well versed in these matters as you are. But it seems to me that to some extent, matzah that is not kosher for Passover should not be allowed to be called matzah.
Well, I hear where you're coming from.
I mean, isn't that inherent? The whole food was invented or it came about as part of what, you know, we celebrate Passover, we observe Passover to commemorate something that happened, and this food is specifically supposed to be, you know, to remind us of that time. And so, like, its history, its design, its creation is so bound up in Passover that it's like I can't separate one from the other.
Well, let me strengthen your argument before I
before you disagree.
Before I tell you why you're wrong. If you would define matzah as unleavened bread, if you want to do that, then your question is exceedingly valid, because if it's unleavened bread, how could you have unleavened bread?
Right.
But basically, matzah has acquired the meaning of being a matzah-style cracker. In other words, a cracker with nothing else but flour and water.
So it's sort of a term of art.
Perhaps.
It's not really...
It has become a culinary term, perhaps.
Okay.
A culinary term is, what do you call an unleavened cracker? When you say unleavened, again, it means that you don't add leavening ingredients in. What do you call such a cracker? You'd call it a matzah cracker or a matzah. But that flour or the process that you're using to make that matzah or that cracker doesn't follow the 18-minute rule. And it may have ingredients in there that's not leavening, but it may have ingredients that are problematic from a kosher for Passover matzah perspective. Now, I want to share with you and your listeners an important thing here, which we're drifting into those waters. I am here to make sure that that all of the products are in the highest level of kosher observance. But there's an awful lot of people, actually the majority of people who use Manischewitz products, don't follow kosher law. And they just want to have that. There's a tremendous attachment to having not only matzah on the table, because, by the way, the Passover, for Jews who are kind of leaving Judaism, the last thing that they're going to lose is usually the Passover Seder. That's the last tradition. But being that, I'll share with you a very interesting difference in the philosophy of non-religious people and religious people. According to the very religious, the more flavors of matzah you have, the better we are. Religious Jews welcome new taste experiences, and which is, of course, what the Sporkful is interested in.
Of course.
But many folks who are not necessarily kosher-oriented, but they're Jewish-oriented, I've gotten phone calls from people saying, you know, it doesn't sound kosher to have a flavored matzah.
Like, you guys have everything matzah.
Correct.
Now, like an everything bagel.
Right,
you sell
correct.
Everything matzah, which correct. I saw that in the store. I was like, arr? I mean.
Right.
That's what I'm picturing as you're
talking about
new taste experience.
Yes, that's what I'm talking about.
But it's interesting. It is interesting that you say that in some ways it's the more observant Jews who are more open to new and different experiences.
Very often that is the case.
In some ways, I think maybe it's because in some ways they're sort of more secure. They feel like, I know I'm following all the rules. So if I want to try something different, it's not a problem. Whereas the people who are more on the fence or less observant are like, well, I for Passover, I want to be sure that I'm doing it the old-fashioned way, in quotes.
Right.
And so they're less likely because they feel like if they do that, it's sort of one more step away from tradition. Let's talk about the Seder observance itself.
Sure.
One of the integral parts of the Seder is charoset. Which is, recipes vary widely, but at its essence, it's chopped apples, usually some chopped nuts, a dash of kosher wine, sweet wine, maybe a little more sugar and some cinnamon.
Right.
And then other people add, there's all different kinds of variations from there. And the charoset is meant to represent mortar.
Correct.
The mortar that the Jews used to build the pyramids in Egypt when we were slaves there.
Correct.
Okay. Now, I think that people need to give more thought to how finely they chop the apples and the nuts in the charoset.
Okay.
Because it's not only representative of mortar, but it is a mortar.
Okay.
It's an actual mortar because part of the Seder is that you eat it on matzah with maror or bitter herbs.
Correct.
Which are meant to symbolize the bitterness of slavery.
Right.
And so, and I talk often about sandwichization in all its forms here on the Sporkful. You need a mortar.
Right.
You need something to hold it together. And if you have charoset with big chunks of apples and big nuts, it's not going to stay on your matzah. When you bite into it, it's going to crumble and fall all over the place. It's not going to act as a good mortar. Is this a valid concern? And are you willing to endorse my belief that if the apples and nuts are chopped too largely for it to act as a good mortar on your matzah, it should not count as charoset?
For a secular question, you got a pretty a pretty legal type of approach to this thing.
That's right.
I am impressed, actually.
Thank you.
I think that, you see, it depends. Again, there are different people who use charoset in different ways. There are those who, as you say, kind of literally pile it on. And, you know, it has to stick onto the matzah if you're going to pile it on. But there are those, and actually traditional law dictates like that, you just have to dip the maror into the charoset. So you don't really need a significant amount of charoset residue to be able to fulfill the traditional obligation for the thing. But to your point, there are a lot of people out there who are waiting for the taste of that charoset because that's an important taste sensation part of the Seder. So I can hear where you're coming from, that the composition of the of the chayrosis would be important for you to get a mouthful. But technically, you know, I myself, for example, I just dip the more into the chayrosis.
You go with horseradish for your maror? Is that your?
I have a mixture, actually, of horseradish and romaine lettuce.
Okay. Do you shred? Is the horseradish shredded or sliced?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. No, shredded.
And how do you, because dipping, when you have a shredded item on top of a piece of matzah, if you slant it to dip it in, you can lose some. It could fall off the matzah.
Well, that's the reason why I use the romaine lettuce and the horseradish, because I put a dollop of horseradish in the romaine lettuce, so it acts like a pita almost. Heaven forbid I should say such a thing by a Passover Seder. But I, you know, I use the romaine lettuce to hold on to the maror as I'm dipping it into the chayrosis.
Matzah sandwichization. Do you make matzah sandwiches? And if so, what do you like to put on them?
It's a problem. Matzah doesn't make a sandwich is because it's crummy.
Right.
I mean, I don't mean it in the wrong connotation. Right. You understand.
It makes a lot of crumbs. You bite into it. Not only does it turn crumbly, but it splinters.
Right, right, right.
I think you really can almost... The only way you can sandwichize matzah is if you have some kind of a sealant. I think if you melt cheese on each side of the matzah, then when you bite into it, the cheese will act as an adhesive. That's a mortar. Right there. That will hold that thing, that sandwich together. Some people will say, oh, well, then just make an open-faced matzah sandwich. But I have argued that an open-faced sandwich is not a sandwich, that it's a misnomer, speaking of language and terminology.
Right, right, right.
I think that to be a sandwich, a food needs to be something that you can pick up with your hands such that your hands do not touch the fillings. Eat it with your hands. And then it needs the fillings of the sandwich need to be sandwiched. As a scholar and man who often studies words and the things that we're allowed to eat and the words that describe the things we're allowed to eat, do you think an open-faced sandwich is a sandwich?
Well, I think that it's pretty fair to say that, you know, our little boat has drifted out of traditional Jewish waters here. and, you know, we have gone to rarefied heights of wisdom that unfortunately I've not been privy to, so I would have to ponder this one for a little while.
Okay, fair enough. Well, Rabbi Horowitz, it's been really a real pleasure to speak with
pleasure
you and to learn so much from you, so thank you so much.
A great pleasure. Best of luck.
That's it for this episode. Do want to let you guys know that when I was talking to Randall Copeland, the first guy we spoke to in this episode, he gave me the recipe for matzah brei that the women who work in the Manischewitz test kitchen, these women from Uzbekistan, make a special kind of matzah brei that's akin to a frittata or a Spanish tortilla. You can actually slice it into wedges. It sounds amazing. I can't wait to try it. And I've posted the recipe to Sporkful.com, so check that out. Also, brief statement of disclosure, want to let you know that I did accept a ride to the Manischewitz factory and back from the folks at Manischewitz. They did provide me with a ride. Of course, they had no editorial input into the creation of this show. But thank you to them. Thank you to you. Remember to connect with The Sporkful on Twitter at The Sporkful, Facebook.com/Sporkful, and online at Sporkful.com. Until next time, I'm Dan Pashman reminding you to eat more, eat better, and eat more better.